This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. On January 20th, at noon Eastern Time, Joe Biden is scheduled to become the 46th President of the United States. My next guest writes that this has been a lifelong ambition for Biden. As a young man, he told his girlfriend's mother that his professional goals included President of the United States. That anecdote and more have been part of a decade's worth of coverage of Biden by Evan Osnos, a staff writer at The New Yorker. Osnos has collected and adapted that work into a new book called Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. Osnos first began covering Biden for The New Yorker as the magazine's correspondent in China. Also of interest to our listeners across Illinois, Osnos also spent about 9 years at the Chicago Tribune, starting as a Metro reporter and moving through assignments in New York, the Middle East, and ultimately as Beijing bureau chief. Evan Osnos, welcome to the 21st.
Hello. And, I'm sorry, I think we had me on mute. It's great to be with you.
Thanks for being here. You know, it's everybody's on Zoom these days. I hope our listeners are forgiving as we all muddle through this pandemic. So, I want to you describe kind of beginning at the end of your book. In the end of your book, you write a note on sources, and you describe first being drawn to Biden as a foreign correspondent. But you write, and I love this quote: "Up close, I came to see him in a more rewarding see in him a more rewarding well of insight into American political culture because of the span of his experience, the range of his emotional intensity, and his difficulty in disguising his thinking with the full depth of horse manure that adorns many encounters in Washington journalism. Biden spins, of course, but not quite as smoothly as others do." And I guess I should tell listeners I did a little on-the-fly substitution with the phrase horse manure there. But my question to you is, what is it actually like talking to Biden one-on-one?
Well, I like that you gravitated to that sentence because it does capture something really important about him and about why he is kind of a fascinating person to write about. And look, the honest answer is that for a long time in Washington, people in the sort of political reporting world just kind of looked past him. They didn't really spend that much time because he was a sort of piece of the political furniture. He'd been here in Washington, where I am, for, by that point, 36 years in the Senate. He'd then been in the vice presidency for a while. And people just kind of didn't think that there was much to learn from him, partly because the vice presidency is a maligned office. But what you discovered when you sat down with him was that he had not gotten to where he was by accident, that he had a very rich sense of American politics and some of the undercurrents, things that were happening. And I'll give you an example. So when I went to see him at one point in the West Wing in 2014, this is before the rise of Bernie Sanders as a political phenomenon, it's certainly before the rise of Donald Trump. And Biden was really going off on his own party. I mean, he was telling me, "I think the Democratic Party is making a big mistake and losing touch with working class Americans." And he made the point to me at some length, and frankly, I was not smart enough to realize that he was picking up on something. And I didn't even quote it when I did a profile of him in The New Yorker that year, because I thought, well, what is he talking about? I can't quite figure it out. And what I realized, of course, in retrospect, was that Joe Biden, as I mentioned in that note that you mentioned at the outset, he will tell you what he thinks. And it's not that he's, you know, every politician has a little bit of bunting that they'll put around the edges to try to frame it in their own terms. But when you ask him a question, very often he will answer it. And that is makes him somebody who is quite addictive as a political subject. And I kept going back and back and back to hear him again.
You know, it's interesting. You say that he sort of put his finger on that working class unrest or dismay, whatever you want to call it. But you also described that the liberals in his party were dismayed by him, right? The most diverse presidential field in history had yielded a white man in his eighth decade. And you have this nice metaphor where you say it was as if a waiter had returned from the kitchen with news that the specials were gone and all that was left was oatmeal. Do you think the left's view of Biden as oatmeal is a fair critique?
it certainly felt that way to many people at the end of this primary. I mean, he really was not the person that they envisioned. Here was this, I mean, it was the most diverse field ever, and he was in some ways the most conservative member and most politically conservative member. He was obviously the oldest. So there was a sense of letdown. And then what happened next is really what interests me, really surprised me, because what you saw over the course of the next few months, and progressive activists have sort of confirmed this for me, is that they were startled to discover that he was doing something very unusual, which is usually a Democrat wins in the primary by moving to their left and then they swing to the right in the general election in order to pick off moderate and independent voters. And he was doing something very different. He, in fact, had run more or less to the right of his competitors during the primary, and then he moved to the left in the general election for a real reason. I mean, it was a serious reason, which is that, as he said to me, look, the Democratic Party is actually a little more moderate than people in the press like to imagine it to be. If you look at the data, a lot of Democrats still today, most Democrats describe themselves as moderate or conservative Democrats. But when you get out into the broader electorate, as he would say, he recognizes that the future of this country is, and this is me talking, not him, but it is more diverse and more progressive ultimately than he is. He sees where the demographics are going. And he understood that he needed to respect that. He had to figure out a way to meet those voters where they were. And so you began to hear him getting more aggressive and ambitious on things like climate change. He embraced elements of Elizabeth Warren's plans for bankruptcy reform and Bernie Sanders' talk of student debt.
Okay, so, yeah, let's come back to that. We need to take a short break. We're going to talk about Joe Biden as a weather vane for the Democratic Party. We're speaking with Evan Osnos, a journalist for The New Yorker, who's got a new book on Joe Biden out. More to come after the break. This is the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. My guest is Evan Osnos. He's the author of Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. It's a collection and adaptation of reporting from the past decade on Biden that Osnos has done for The New Yorker, where he's a staff writer. And before the break, we were talking about Biden as sort of adopting a lot of progressive policy positions. And he puts Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in charge of his climate task force with Senator Bernie Sanders, where they're trying to come to some meeting of the minds on policy moving forward.
Actually, Senator John Kerry, just to point that out, you know, former Secretary of State John Kerry. It wasn't Bernie Sanders actually on the climate change panel.
Right. No, but I'm sorry. I meant the panel that was part of the broader set of efforts to come to a meeting of the minds with Bernie Sanders. Yeah. But I'm interested in this idea of Biden as a weather vane. And that's a phrase that or a term that you quote a senior Obama administration official using, particularly in relation to the way Biden got out ahead of Obama on same-sex marriage. And this is sort of a recurring theme in his political career, right? That he is able to have this sense of where the Democratic Party is going and adapt. I mean, he's at one point an anti-busing person in the 70s, and yet also, you know, is ultimately helped by Congressman Clyburn in South Carolina. And it's really arguably black voters that that helped elevate him in mm-hmm. the primary this year. Can you talk about his sense of following Democratic voters where they're going before other people seem to pick up on it, maybe?
Yeah, it's a really interesting theme that runs through his political life. I mean, sort of before he was before he was opposed to court-ordered busing, he was actually in favor of it. I mean, this is where you see him. This is really a reflection of his specific territory at the time. He comes out of, and I think it shapes the life, the political life that follows. You know, he came out of Delaware, which was really this kind of hybrid of the North and the South. It had Jim Crow laws in effect in places, but it was also closer to New York City than to Raleigh, North Carolina. So he really had elements of both traditions in his district. And so at one point, when he ran for office and was elected on the basis partly of a civil rights platform. He participated in some small desegregation protests. And then he got criticized by mostly white suburban voters in his district who said, we don't want to have busing. And so he changed his position. This was in 1973. And what's interesting is that you see over the course of his career that he has very often been evolving and changing with the mood of the electorate and the American public. And that line, which I think you so rightly pulled out, which was somebody worked with him very closely in the Obama administration, said to me, he is in many ways like a weather vane for the center of the Democratic Party. And that's sort of the key other piece of the description, because he's very rarely sort of at the very front. He's not a pioneer. And he's also usually not the person at the very back who's kind of being dragged along. He's usually right there in the middle. And that used to be something, I mean, as he would call himself a centrist. Today, he's less inclined to do that. But I think it's still very much, if you had to put a name to Joe Biden's ideology, you would say that he is a centrist fundamentally.
I want to talk about Biden's time in the Senate. I think a lot of people are probably by now familiar with the crash and how that affected his early life. You write that he contemplated suicide after his wife and infant daughter were killed in a car crash and his young sons were injured. One of them was in the hospital for quite some time. And he sort of, I think it's also probably a little more well known now that he was sort of embraced as family by a lot of senior senators, and it gave him this unusual relationship with the Senate, and that over time he was particularly saddened the way the Senate sort of lost some of that comedy and became more combative. Can you talk about maybe the change in the Senate from the time Biden was elected to when he left it to become vice president?
Well, I mean, as the culture of it fundamentally changed. I mean, when he got in there at this moment in the mid-1970s, political polarization in this country was very low. And as a result, you had senators from opposite parties who would collaborate on bills. It was very common that you would have these pieces of legislation that had these kinds of eclectic coalitions put together. And you know, voters at that point also tended to split their tickets more often. They might vote for a Republican for president and a Democrat for Congress and so on. And as we all know, those trends have really just changed fundamentally over the course of the last generation and a half, so two generations, to the point that by the time he left the Senate in 2008 to become Barack Obama's vice president, they had divided themselves into these two separate camps, and they very rarely collaborated on bills anymore. It was a kind of throwback. He and John McCain used to occasionally sit together on the floor of the Senate chamber. They were very close friends, and they collaborated on things. But at one point, they actually were sitting together, just sort of, you know, chewing the fat. And leaders of both of their caucuses pulled them aside and said, look, it doesn't look good for you guys to be hanging out on the other side of the aisle. It's not the right idea. And Biden hated that. And, you know, he still clung to this idea that you could find ways to collaborate even if you disagreed on some issues. And he carries that idea with him. And I think it's both an asset and then also a real challenge for him, a potential weakness, because, you know, on the asset side, he really believes it's possible to strike a compromise, and he doesn't go into a room assuming that it's impossible. But it means that he's also in some ways shaped by the memory, you might call it the muscle memory, of those days when there were Republicans who were more inclined to meet a Democratic president than they are now. And he has to be careful that he doesn't go into office with his hand extended and end up just sort of standing around with nobody to shake it. And I think that worries a lot of Democrats.
Yeah, and that's the question, isn't it? Because President Obama went into office with this message of unity and reconciliation, and you have an interesting quote from President Obama that it's probably taken him a little time to let go of that, talking about Biden and this idea of Congress as a place of compromise and negotiation. And interestingly, I think a lot of people would say Obama maybe took a little time to let go of that as well. Do you think that Biden has a more realistic understanding of this? And you know, beyond that, will his connections with Mitch McConnell, other senators, you know, can he parlay that into legislative achievements? Or do you think McConnell will be as committed to making the Biden-Harris ticket a one-term presidency?
Well, it is, you know, I think a lot of this rests on Mitch McConnell. And it's bizarre that we, frankly, are sort of captive as much as we are as a political culture to the whims and appetites of one senator. But that's the reality of how it is these days. When I spoke to President Obama over this most recent summer for this book, I asked him about that question. And I said, how do you think it will work for Joe Biden if he goes in with the same approach that you had? And he said, you know, the word that he used, which really sort of stayed with me, was he said, I think it's been painful for Joe to give up that memory of what it used to be like. And yet at the same time, they do arrive with very different circumstances. The truth is that, and I really do emphasize this these days because it's easy to overlook. You hear so much from Joe Biden about unity, about, you know, no red states and no blue states. But he is not a babe in the woods. He's been at this a very long time. 48 years ago was when he first elected to the Senate. And as one of his advisors said to me not long ago, look, plan A is going to be unity and comedy. And if it doesn't work, plan B is scorched earth. They know how to use the tools of government. All of his people who are coming in at the top have experience doing it. They know how to pull the levers. They know how to use the executive branch very effectively to get things done, even if they can't get, meaning that they can set priorities, for instance, within individual departments about how to spend money and about what to prosecute and what not to prosecute. They can still pursue an agenda. But Joe Biden's relationship with McConnell is really different than Obama's. And I think it's worth just pointing that out. I mean, McConnell was, after all, the only Republican senator who attended Beau Biden's funeral in 2015. And the two of them hammered out a deal once they kind of, we forget these various deals now, but the fiscal cliff deal back during the second end of the first Obama administration. You know, that began when Obama and McConnell had reached an impasse and McConnell picked up the phone, called Biden in his office in the West Wing and said, is there anybody over there who knows how to make a deal? So these two, they do have some history. And but I am very cautious. I am realistic. And I think we all should be at this point. We should all be asking perhaps why it is Mitch McConnell has not yet had a conversation with Joe Biden or acknowledged the fact that he's the president-elect. I mean, this is the Senate Majority Leader of the United States, and he has not acknowledged political reality. That's a strange set of events to be contending with.
Yeah, and not necessarily an auspicious beginning. I suppose we should add that we don't yet know who will control the Senate. I suppose it's conceivable, although the prognosticators say unlikely, that the Democrats could pick up the two seats in Georgia, and that would certainly change the dynamic. But I'm struck by, you know, reading your book, which I presume, I know it came out before the election was held in October, you know, when discussions just a couple of months ago were how much should Democrats pack the Supreme Court? When should they eliminate the filibuster? I mean, all that seems to be quickly, that conversation seems to be changing. Do you see progressive Democrats moderating themselves to adapt to that reality, or will there continue to be this tension in the Democratic Party?
Well, I think, I mean, there's no choice among progressives but to moderate their hopes for what might be possible with legislation because of the lay of the land. It's just, it, you know, they'd be screaming into a void at this point if they said, why is it that President-elect Biden is not pursuing maximalist progressive policies? It's just not possible. But you know what I hear from progressives that I find really interesting is that there's an interesting moment right now. Actually, it was Varshini Prakash, who's one of the co-founders of the Sunrise Movement, which is a really dynamic climate change organization, mostly led by young people. And she said to me that if Biden wins, then we will face this really interesting moment. And it's a challenge for us as a movement, which is to say that we can't just, and I'm paraphrasing here, but we can't just more or less abandon him at the first sign of moderation, because if that's the case, then we'll be in the wilderness for the next 4 years. But we have to figure out a line, a path between complacency and righteousness. We have to figure out a way to move from protest to policy. I mean, that's the phase where they are now. And I think progressives are looking at some of these early appointments that he's made. And you've heard a lot of positive reaction to names like John Kerry. I mean, climate activists, even very progressive climate activists, are pleased to hear John Kerry as a new envoy, special, very senior envoy for climate. They're very pleased with Janet Yellen. Elizabeth Warren called her an outstanding choice for Treasury Secretary because she's somebody who does pay a lot of attention to unemployment, making sure that workers get a fair deal. So there are not yet a lot of reasons to say that Joe Biden is turning his back on progressives in a curious way. But, you know, he will have to do more. I mean, he will constantly. And that's the way our system is designed. I mean, this is something interesting President Obama said to me when he talked about the pressure that Biden will get from the left. He said, that's how the system's supposed to work. You know, they should pressure him. And I think Biden knows that. And it's one of the reasons why you see him making these pretty serious efforts to try to reflect that more diverse, ideologically diverse spectrum of ideas in his cabinet.
Well, if listeners, if you want to understand where Joe Biden has been, where he's coming from, and where we may be going, I would recommend Evan Osnos's book. It's called Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. Evan Osnos is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and before that was Beijing bureau chief and had other postings with the Chicago Tribune. Evan Osnos, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.
And that is all the time we have for today. On tomorrow's show, we'll be talking about how to manage COVID fatigue, that feeling of being tired of the pandemic and all the fear and isolation that comes with it. If you've noticed yourself or those around you experiencing more COVID fatigue, we want to know, how are you coping with it? Are you feeling that? You can leave us a voicemail at 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. Remember to mention your name and town in your message, and you might hear your response on the show tomorrow. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Eunice Alpesan is our outgoing engagement producer. I'm sorry to say her time with us is coming to an end. We want to thank Eunice for all the great work she's done with Text the 21st and bringing that online. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. We'll be back again tomorrow.